Hey everybody, welcome to episode 2. I'm here today with Miguel de Casa. Let's jump in. I'm excited to introduce Miguel de Casa. Miguel, can you tell us, we always start with name, rank, and serial number. So like what is, tell us about your role at Microsoft.
All right, I run the team that builds Xamarin, the platform. So think our mobile developer platform for iOS and Android. I run the Visual Studio team, Visual Studio for Mac team, and the Mono team, which is the runtime that powers these things. And so that's what I do.
Okay, cool. And I think like in our last episode, we had Fowler, and David Fowler, he's an architect, and you have a entirely different kind of role. You're a distinguished engineer here. Can you give folks just a little bit? I want to give people a sense of like both your role and like how we kind of categorize things so that we can kind of use that as a framework to talk about.
Okay, well, I'm new at Microsoft, so I am going to struggle a little bit with defining what that is.
How do you think about it?
You know, we work in a very interesting space. The mobile space is a space that is evolving very rapidly.
Yeah.
And what we're trying to do here is we're trying to blend our developer tools and our programming systems, right? The .NET language, F# language, and make sure that those work well on these mobile environments. And you know, these are platforms that are not static. They're constantly evolving. They're constantly changing. And there are new challenges year after year. We look at this period roughly March to June with a little bit of trepidation because Android introduces new things, Apple introduces new things, and we want to have a perfect mapping, or we want to make sure that .NET developers have every tool at their disposal. They are never behind their native counterparts. So it's a very interesting set of problems that we have to solve year after year. Some years are easy, some years are more challenging, And there are things that impact the language. So some of the things that we're seeing in C# 8, some of the things that happen in C# 7, are directly derived from things that we wanted to solve in the mobile space. Changes that we want to see in the runtime, some upcoming features that are, you know, some pull requests on GitHub and CoreFX and CoreCLR and so on, are about having better interop.
Okay.
With these systems, making sure that .NET keeps evolving. Right. It's a you know, we call it the upcoming version is .NET Core 3, but the reality is that it should be called maybe it should be really .NET 8, right? Because it's 4.7. Right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It really should be .NET 8. So if it was purely linear, and
we've never been accused of having great versioning numbers here.
People think that there's a deficit of numbers. You know, they're scared of incrementing those numbers.
So like in your job then, you have like you're a manager, you run a relatively large organization as well as you do sort of architectural work in terms of like directing what we do next.
And there's a research piece, there's a figuring out piece, there's a coaching piece, right? We have a lot of engineers with different backgrounds and a lot of them are experts at what they do, and we try to you know, it's a big complex problem. Not everybody knows everything about it, about the product or even the environment. So we really need to sit down with every one of the players. We need to get the best ideas out, and we need to synthesize, extract, figure out what the solution is going to be.
A lot of cross-partner work.
And we work with your organization, right? We work people in your organization. Steve runs the .NET team, right? So we work with language people on your team, with the VM people, with library people, tooling people, package people, right?
Okay, so at this point, I want to.
Yes.
We're gonna keep shifting around in time.
All right.
So now we're gonna go back to early career, Miguel, and we're gonna start with sort of your early contributions in terms of like I know you come from, unlike Fowler, who we talked to in episode one, you kind of come from an origin story starts in the free and open source software.
Right. Yep.
Tell me about that.
So I was one day coming out of a calculus class and. A friend of mine that I idolized, that I probably saw once every 3 months, was walking around with a stack of papers. And I was like, how's it going? He's like, well, I know that you have a new Sun workstation, and here's a list of software that you can download. And it was just a print of FTP sites. you know, he knew that I had the machines that he wanted me to have software in my machine. And I said, well, what is this stuff? What should I get? And he's like, well, you should get the compilers from the GNU project and the editor so you can use the machines. It's like, well, I should look
at it. Are you getting a CS degree in this part of the story?
Math degree.
Math degree.
And So I go and download these things, and I read the documentation, and I am surprised to find this GNU manifesto, right? So I start using the tools, Emacs and the compilers, and they have all kinds of tools. I download it all, and it's all free software. And I cannot believe, and this is 1988, 89 maybe,
okay.
Or 90, I can't remember, 1990, I think. And I cannot believe that somebody's giving away all this stuff, and in particular, an optimizing C compiler, which for a Mexican in that time and age, it was just, I would read them in magazines, right? The Portland C compiler was a thing. And there were these expensive numbers, right? And for a Mexican, it was unbelievable.
And so the ability to kind of get that for free was like
yes.
a real
and this
game changer.
Guy, Richard Stallman, is giving it away for free. So I read the GNU Manifesto, and I felt that I owed him and I owed the project my contribution. So I tried to figure out how to help. And my first contribution was a file manager. I came from the DOS world. And in DOS, we had this file manager called Norton Commander. I don't know if you ever used it.
Yep.
But so I couldn't really, I liked Unix, but I really needed my Norton Commander. So I wrote myself a Norton Commander, and I emailed Richard, and I say, hey, I want to make this part of the GNU project. And he took it. And that's how I started to write open source software, or free software. And I still use it to this day. That is my file manager.
Yeah, I've actually seen you use
yes,
it.
Yes. I still.
I was like, what's that? He's like, let me tell you about what this is.
And 29 yeah. years. 29 yeah. years using my own software. So it starts there. And then I worked on, years later, I worked in the Linux kernel. Again, at that time, I had a passion for, I had a Sun computer, a Spark computer. And it was running SunOS. Linux was a thing. And I wanted to get Linux there. So I joined forces with David Miller, who's now, you know, one of the leaders and veterans of the Linux kernel. But at the time, he was very young, like me. And we started porting Linux to the Spark architecture.
Cool.
Because we thought Spark was going to be the future. And so we did. I did a bunch of device drivers, the graphics driver, network drivers. He did the SCSI driver. He did the interrupt handlers. Then I work with Ingo Molnar on the Ray device drivers. And then I interviewed at Microsoft. I don't know what order that happened. But I interviewed at Microsoft. Oh, yeah, because I was doing the Spark work. A friend of mine, Randy Chapman, said, hey, they're porting IE to the Spark. Do you want to come? And I came here, and they explained to me how it worked. It's all components, and it's little pieces. Like, oh my god, I love components, small pieces. We gotta get on that.
Smaller the better.
And just around this time, we had a challenge in the free software world, which was Linux didn't really have a good desktop. And a desktop emerged called KDE, but it was built on a proprietary technology. And Richard said, well, this is a problem. We can't rely.
No,
the future of Linux or free software cannot rely on a proprietary piece of software. And we tried to negotiate, we talked to Red Hat, we tried to figure something out, nothing happened. And eventually I said, Richard, let me launch a project. So with Richard and Red Hat, we launched the GNOME project, which was a free desktop, whose goal really was to replace all these proprietary pieces with open source pieces. And I devoted years of my life to that. That became the GNOME project, the GNOME desktop. It's still going, and it's you know, I've not been involved with the project for many years, but it laid the foundation for governance of open source projects in a very interesting way. We set up a foundation and a structure for the board of directors that is very influential, and it is the scheme that we've replicated now with the .NET Foundation. So our upcoming elections are actually based on the GNOME Foundation. Board of directors, the way that we vote, the way that you campaign, the limits on the board.
I see all that stuff is based on sort of patterns.
Yes,
that you
it all came back from GNOME. And GNOME has done tremendous work. They launched the Outreachy program, which was about coaching minorities into open source, and now it's a thing on its own. So it's been a really fantastic foundation.
Okay, so how does Mono come into the universe?
So at this point, we are building a lot of the gaps in GNOME. So I built a spreadsheet, somebody else wrote a word processor, somebody else was writing a presentations program,
it's cool
and music.
To be able to lay out this whole
We're
ecosystem.
Trying to do everything. Yeah. And the problem is we are writing code in C, machines are slow. We know that we want to raise the programming level. And, well, we try Python, we try Perl, we try Scheme. It was a big thing in the GNU days to use Scheme and Lisp. And there was a paper, very famous paper about you should do everything in Lisp, in Scheme. And we realized interpreters just are not going to cut it. This is the year 2000, right? Year 2000, machines with 64 megs of RAM, you know, maybe 60 megahertz or 100 megahertz computers. So interpreters, they don't cut it, right?
Got it.
And then Microsoft comes out and launches this thing called C#. And it is a blend of a high-level language with high performance, right? And we had evaluated Java, but Java had a problem. Java was free as in price, but was proprietary.
I see.
And while the open source community had tried to clone it, there was really no drivers. Like, well, a lot of people were like, well, we have the free one.
I see.
Why
so there wasn't there was no driver. Demand. Yeah.
So when Microsoft came out with .NET, we said, well, maybe we can use this thing. And we went and launched a project to bring .NET to Linux. Microsoft had published the specs through a standards organization called ECMA. We said, well, let's put this on Linux. And let's see if we can get people. And out of the blue, thousands of people, well, hundreds of people started contributing.
Got it.
So it was very different than Java because there was no free .NET.
I see. So you were creating some, like, the standardization makes this possible.
Yes.
And then effectively, because there's not already a quote unquote free version of it, but
we had nothing.
You had the opportunity to walk into a place where there'd be a value proposition for actually working on this thing. And so people come out of the woodworks to help.
And we had very limited scope at the beginning. This is just for helping us build Linux desktop apps. That was our original goal, nothing else. And then people started contributing, ASP.NET and ADA.NET and WinForms. And so the thing grew out of control and it took on a life on its own. And I worked for many years on that. I had a company with my friend Nat in doing desktop applications. That's where we built Mono. That company got acquired by Novell. We worked at Novell in the Linux desktop for many years. And towards the end of the Novell era,
Where are we in time?
This is 2008, 2009, Apple launches the iPhone. And we had been working with this tiny little game company called Over the Edge Entertainment, OT. And Over the Edge Entertainment had a game engine that was scripted with Python. It was very slow. And they were looking for a way of making their games faster.
Okay.
So they looked at Mono and said, can we take Mono and embed it on our engine? I said, sure, we'll help you. So we've been helping this little company called OT, OTE.dk, ever since, maybe 2006, 2005. So this little company later renamed themselves and they were called Unity. And there was a year.
Perhaps you've heard of them.
You probably heard of it. So in 2008, we're meeting with them, and they have a little booth, maybe the size of this area, at GDC.
Oh, at GDC, okay. And where you're headed to after this, I think.
I'm going to GDC. We're meeting with them. Oh, this is very painful. And they said, you should invest in NOS. And I said, I'll think about it. I'm going to see if Novell lets me invest. And Novell said, this will be a conflict of interest. So I went back to Unity and said, I'm sorry, I cannot invest.
Oh,
the Novell lawyer says, so it's very painful memory. Anyways, so Apple launches the iPhone and Unity comes to us and says, hey, could you get Mono running on this thing? And my team, and I love my team that we had assembled at Novell. And I'm still working with them, by the way. They're here, right? That team, I've been working with them since 2001. So we put Mono on the iPhone. And this little company that had 5 employees at the time, we gave them Mono for iPhone, and they bundled this with Unity, and they hit the market at the right time. And within a year, Unity went from 5 employees to 75. And they have this massive booth at GDC, right? And we thought, man, this is this iPhone thing has some legs.
Got it.
So we decided, well, let's take Mono, and instead of doing games, let's do business apps.
Got
right?
It.
So let's put .NET there.
And this is Xamarin.
And that became Xamarin, yep.
Okay, and then Xamarin, you guys ran for a while, and then when did you get acquired?
Yeah, so we did we launched this part in 2009. There was a fascinating story that is too long to tell about a hostile takeover of Novell, but they lay us off in 2011, and I rehired my team that was laid off. I called Nat, he was on vacation, and said, hey, we're all laid off.
We should probably say for the audience, you're talking about Nat Friedman, who's now the
CEO of GitHub. And I say, hey, we've been laid off, and I really love this technology. I love Mono, I love .NET, and I think there's an opportunity here in the mobile space. Let's do something. So he was on a world trip around the world, and he says, all right, I'm going to cancel my vacation. I'm coming in. So he canceled his vacation. He says, well, actually, you mind if we just got here to Barbados? It was in some island in the Caribbean. He's like, you mind if we just stay here for 2 days? Like, sure, sure. So he flew in on Wednesday, and we started the company at that point. And then we went to Novell, and we say, hey, you have this IP. You don't care about it. Why don't we find a solution? We negotiated a license. They gave us the IP. We built the product. We launched. And
rest is history.
Yes. So they say. And then, we built a company around mobile development. And Microsoft acquired a company in 2016. And Nat kind of went on to do Visual Studio TS on the services side.
Yep.
And that became GitHub.
And you kind of took forward the mobile vision.
Yeah. I'm in the box, and he's the server.
The services
guy. So.
Yeah. All right, cool. Let's transition at this point. So we went all the way to the back, and now we're back caught up to sitting in Redmond with the plants and talking. All right, so now let's start walking backwards again. We're gonna start walking backwards through important career inflections. So we covered a few in here.
Okay.
What were the last few places where you felt like you either had to make an important career decision? You could have turned left, you could have turned right. And I want to talk about how you navigated those pivots.
Well, I think it's gotta be the day they lay us off, right?
Yeah.
It's a day where there was an easy choice, which would have been, I'll just go and apply at a job at a big company. A bunch of big tech, high tech companies are hiring.
Sure.
But I've always felt very protective of my team, and I had a little bit of a. Felt a little bit responsible.
Like if you would have gone off somewhere else, then sure, you could have been fine. But you kind of wanted to take
and we have a
do something with this group of people that you'd put together. Is that sort of the way to think about it?
Sort of. So I've always had always felt very protective of my team and what is going to happen. Some of them are remote employees. It's difficult in some countries. Maybe. Anyways, so I figured it's worth a shot. It is worth a shot. Joseph, who was also laid off with me, I said, well, why don't we try to build a company? Usually when these things happen, when there's layoffs, they say, hey, you gotta leave the offices. Here's a box, take your stuff.
Yeah, sure.
And we called Novell and we say, hey, listen, let us use your office for a couple of weeks while we figure out what to do. They give you 2 week notice.
Sure.
And I said, sure, you can use them, right? So to their credit, they said, yeah, you can use the office for 2 weeks. And there were 2 weeks of us thinking, what do we do?
How
do
we use their whiteboards to plan out the future?
Yeah, they came to us and make us a proposal for the IP. So we used those 2 weeks to kind of think through these things. And there was an easy way out.
Did you have entrepreneurship experience at this point?
Well, I had done a previous company with Nat, right? So this is our second company. Nat and myself have done two companies. One was this Linux company that we founded in 1999.
And then we sold it to Novell.
And then this was again 2011. So we knew it was
in some ways you were replaying a template that you'd previously.
Yeah, and I think that it learned a valuable lesson, right? The valuable lesson with the first company is it is very difficult to make money with open source.
Okay.
Selling open source software, you can't do that. So you need to find alternatives, maybe services, maybe extensions, maybe some proprietary add-ons. So. With Xamarin, it was very clear that we had an open core. So Mono was open source.
Yeah.
So we kept that open core. And then we had all the things that did the iOS and Android integration. And those we kept proprietary.
I see.
Right? And that was a commercial product. And it was an expensive product. I think the cheap version was $400 per license.
The
enterprise was $1,000. And then if
Is that
you wanted
per developer
to. Per developer, per platform.
Per developer, per platform.
So it was an expensive product, but.
But when you compared business A to business B, you felt like because you'd learned that lesson from business A,
I didn't do
you had a way
a
that, yes. that you could actually yes, fund yes, this yes. thing and make it be a goal.
And in fact, what is really nice about this is that the first year, we didn't take any VC the first year. We were self-funded up to 78 employees.
Oh, wow.
So we were making enough money to pay salaries for 78 people within a year. I mean, the mobile space was really growing very quickly. And We were self-funded.
By what you mean, on you were selling licenses
yes.
of Xamarin.
And we were paying salaries out of the licenses, right? There was there was no VC involvement. Ned and I put some money in at the beginning. We were paying ourselves a minimum wage. That was the only downside. But we could only grow the company at a rate that as the sales came in, right? So
we could
probably add a couple more people every month. Or
sometimes it gives you discipline, like a sort of self-enforced discipline.
But at this point, so there was a VC in Boston that kept coming to us, friends of ours that had funded our first company, and they had offered to fund us. And we said, you know what? I think we're just going to do like a lifestyle company, right? It's just lifestyle thing. We'll sell this thing and we'll just make our money. And but about a year into the business, again, we're up to 78 employees. It's like we have all these competitors. There's a lot of competitors in the space, a lot of mobile companies entering the space. And we realized this is we can become a big player if we have more sales, documentation, support. So there's also these functions that we didn't have.
Right.
And we knew we wanted to go to those things. And that's when we took VC. But we were self-funded the first year.
This is another kind of pivot. You had to decide when the right time to do that.
Yes. And I think if I do it again, probably would have taken VC earlier.
Got it.
We could have accelerated a few things. But, you know, it wasn't bad. And it was a matter of pride for both Nat and myself that we were self-funded for the first year. And that we had a business and it was working and it was selling and people liked it. But I think the other lesson that was very interesting for us was really the things that we did to have returning customers. We sold licenses in a per year basis. And a year later, we would call people up and say, hey, you want to renew? And a lot of people said, no, not really. Mm. I didn't use the product, or the product was too difficult, or I couldn't get past this point, or we didn't really use it. So what was really interesting is that we learned that we had to roll out a support team because that ensured that people were successful, that a year later they would renew. We launched Xamarin University, because if people knew how to use a product, they would stick together.
Yeah.
And so all of these were churn measuring activities. And then I think that the stunt, because neither one of us went to business school, we realized, Nat talked to the CEO of Unity, and they exchanged some ideas. And one of these ideas that for Microsoft, it probably sounds like, yeah, of course, was this idea that we would talk to companies and say, tell you what, you have three developers with this thing, you will pay $6,000, tell you what, why don't you give us $10,000 and we'll give you unlimited licenses, right? So then he says, all right, so we'll get unlimited licenses. So they would put 20 developers on the project. So
and then
more people used it.
Wins out of that you can then use to market.
And then the year later, they would come back and says, well, turns out we now have 20 people on this. What is the price, right? So it's like kind of the enterprise sales model.
I see.
So you give them all you can eat. But that ensures that you never think twice about, should I use a product or not? Am I worthy or not? Am I going to ask for $1,000 worth of license or not? Right? Yes, everybody in the company has a license. You just use it. And it is, and essentially, you grow internally inside the company. And then a year later, you come back and you renew. It's like, this delivers the value that we want. And we'll sign up for a larger product.
So that's interesting to me. How did you guys become, like you said, none of you went to business school. You weren't. How did you learn to do this?
Yeah, you kind of learn it on the job.
It sounds like you got some support from friends at Unity who had previously gone through the experience.
Yeah. Well, this is Riticello, right? So that's quite a high friend. No, but one of there was this interesting thing that happened in our first company. This is 2001. And we realized, we're running the company. He's a CEO. I'm doing engineering. But we kind of, everybody reports to everybody. And one day we sat down and we go, people should only report to one of us. They shouldn't report to two of us. So we should figure out who reports to who. And I was like, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And that was fantastic. And I was like, we're geniuses. And,
data structures.
And I'm on vacation. I'm on vacation like 6 months later in Mexico with a friend. And my friend is with his girlfriend. And I was like, oh, so what are you doing? Oh, I studied business administration. Like, well, yeah, Oh, okay. And at this point, I was like, business administration. Who studies that, right? And she's telling me this story over breakfast, like, oh, yeah, I went to this company. These idiots. I mean, even the most basic stuff they don't get. They have people reporting to two bosses. Like, who does that? I'm like, so that's what you learn in business school. Interesting. So, you know, there's lessons like that that you learn on the
job.
Did
you bring somebody in, though, or did you?
No. I mean, eventually,
the books.
At Zimian, the first company, we did bring a CEO. But, you know, you still make mistakes and you still learn. And Zimian was very tough because we're trying to make open source work.
Yeah.
An open source business. So that was suicidal. Never again. And, you know, kudos to everybody trying right now in the marketplace to make this happen.
But
it's tough.
Hard.
It's a tough business.
Not recommended. Would not do again.
You know, there's a part of passion in there. But, you know, for me, I think now I found the space where I think I can operate and I enjoy.
Got it.
So there's that.
So anything before that? Is there a previous pivot point that you feel is like a place where you really had to make a choice, and how did you A, recognize that it was one, and B, you know, make that choice?
The other thing that was really eye opening to me was these. I went to a conference, and at the end of the day, there was a dinner. And they said, "Oh, you gotta go listen to this guy. He was supposed to do the session at noon, but he couldn't make his flight. You should go listen to him."
It's like, all right, it's like some open source conference.
It was a business conference.
Got it.
And they invited me there, and I just don't want to brag about that. But so we go there, and he's the director of the Boston Philharmonic.
So
he's telling this story about his learnings from teaching students to play music. Mm-hmm. And he has this challenge. People learn to play an instrument, but they take out, the schooling system takes out imagination and creativity and passion out of them, right? So he describes his job as undoing the damage, right? And one of the things that he talks about is about, you know, the positive attitude that he tries to give his students. And he has a book about this called The Art of Possibility. And to me, that was eye-opening because it changed my outlook on problems, right? What problems you could tackle and which ones you couldn't tackle. So, you know, to this day, I go to his concerts in Boston.
That's cool.
I just had the Beethoven one a couple of months ago.
So it's like effectively from that experience, you kind of, it opened your horizons to like how big the problems that you could solve is, or you just made you feel
more
empowered?
Yeah, I mean, he has a whole thing.
Empowered?
I mean,
what was the
thing about the possibility thing is that, and I see this a lot with engineers. Engineers, we have this defect as engineers because we're writing software that we tend to be very precise, and we look for the mistakes, for the one-off errors, the all these things, and we obsess over those things, and sometimes we don't see the big picture, right? And I see this a lot with young engineers that kind of have a sense of despair. It's like, well, we can't do this, and it's a spiral of despair, in particular in open source projects. So when you're trying to get people to work together, it's like, how do you infuse a sense of we can do it, and calm down, we're gonna get it done, right?
Yeah, in fact, in Microsoft parlance, I guess this is like generating energy and
a little bit,
figuring
right?
out how to generate optimism in a situation.
Right.
You got these people with default pessimism as sort of our native state as engineers.
Yes. So, you know, I learned a lot from that. That was a very good experience. And the other one was a personal one. When I was running my spreadsheet, my numeric spreadsheet, this is in 1998.
Yeah.
Right, so.
Where you're trying to add it for the Linux desktop.
Yeah, so I'm trying to build a clone of Excel.
Sure.
Right, you know, you have to know, well, what you have to know is that I've been trying to undermine and destroy Microsoft since 1992.
Don't tell anyone.
So, you know, I tried to compete with them. You know, I worked on the Wine project, so we could run Windows binaries and Linux. I worked on Linux kernel. I worked on the GNOME desktop, on spreadsheets.
Now you're hiding in plain sight.
Yeah. I got Sun to open open source Office, right? We had an agreement with Zimian and Sun to open source in exchange for Evolution, et cetera. So, yeah, it's been a long career. So, anyways, I'm building this thing to compete with Microsoft, the spreadsheet, and there's no Google at this point, right? So you can't really Google for solutions from Mexico. How do you implement a spreadsheet? I don't know how to implement the spreadsheet. I don't know how the algorithm works. You know, it's kind of magic, right?
Right.
But I can write UI code. So I figured I'll at least build the UI. So we had this really cool technology for display. So I built the bars, the thing, the resizing, the double click to adjust. So I implement all the cute features in the spreadsheet.
I was going to say, like, I actually have this strong belief system that maybe this is gatekeeping and that's bad. But like, for some reason, every engineer at some point in their life has to build a data grid. I don't know why.
Oh,
it's just this thing you learn.
I have to say, you should download it after this because it is beautiful. And and I was cloning pieces of the UI of Excel, and I liked it. And you know, the Greg and the you click on the thing and you extrapolate and extrapolates the value. So implement an extrapolation engine. And one day, you know, I'm showing this to people. I was like, but what about the formulas? Oh, I haven't figured that out. So the thing doesn't do any formulas. Nothing. It cannot do anything. I could keep putting it off and add more features to the UI. So the UI is getting better and better and. You know, it's smooth scrolling and it doesn't do any flickering. So, you know, you obsess over these things. And one day it's like, okay, that's it. I'm not going to touch a computer until I figure out how to compute expressions. And I had the expression evaluator, but not the recursive one, right? So
Got
how
it.
Do you compute expressions when you have dependencies? And how do you stop the computation and so on? And I said, and I took a look at, GNU had a spreadsheet. So I took a look at that source code. It was terrible. It computed things left to right, top to bottom. So if a cell referenced from here, then the value was wrong. It was terrible, just absolutely. So that was called GNU SC. Terrible, terrible spreadsheet. So I said, no computers for me until I figure this out.
Like, isn't the sense that you're going to do this on paper? Or
yeah,
like,
I'm going to just do it on paper. And I was ready to spend a month without touching a computer. I got the notepad out and I started sketching. And 5 minutes later, it's like, oh, this can't be this easy. I'm like, let me try this. Like, oh, I guess this would work. So, anyways, a thing that I had been agonizing for like a semester, right? 6 months of work.
Right.
I've been just dreading that moment that this impossible task was gonna come. And it turned out to be a 5-minute hack.
And basically, you're in the way of yourself here solving the problem.
Yes,
that's
so,
the whole story.
But it was really eye-opening that some of these things that look like daunting tasks from a distance turned out to be these minimal things, right? And I am very proud of that computation engine. I believe it's better than the one in Excel, or it was in 1999. We got all the recursive computation and the stop the parameters. And very proud of that.
Got it. All right.
Anyways, those are
gears again.
Okay.
Okay. Career advice. What is the best piece of career advice that you've actually been able to utilize?
Career advice.
Have you had a person who's like a mentor in your career? Somebody who, you know, has been there to like kind of show you the next thing, or has that not?
No.
Been a thing
you know what
really
happened? Nat and I had a very good relationship where we would bounce off ideas.
So you had like an opposite number who you could kind of work
yes.
together to get better.
And you know, a lot of people coached us over the years. It's hard to remember them.
But
all,
you didn't have like a long running.
No.
Specific.
No, but a lot of people.
But Nat.
You know, VCs, and Nat and myself always talked. Also, our investors in both companies usually gave us, usually was good guidance and good observations on the industry. So they've done this a number of times. So they're usually very good at giving you some of that.
To give you the specific hints that you needed at those, especially in the places where you had sort of a knowledge gap in terms of the business
right.
training.
And they're friends, right? We made a lot of friends over the years in the open source community. So, you know, you would meet interesting people at conferences. And I really think that at conferences, the hallway conversation is probably one of the most mm-hmm. useful ones. So, you know, nobody really famous. I mean, there's maybe some famous people, but people that
it's
you talk
like
in the hallway.
Community. Like, so you can imagine that there's a model that is pretty common. Like in our first episode where we talked to David Fowler, he talked about his sort of mentorship underneath another architect who kind of taught him almost at every phase along his way. It's almost like in your story, there's more of a community thing here where had one great partner who was somebody who you could always bounce back and forth with and that you developed kind of together.
Mm-hmm.
But then also you just relied on this like very large network of people.
And the other piece that is a culture shock for me, and I think for a lot of us, is when we built, when we were working on Linux, when we were working on GNOME, Xamarin, Zeemian, Evolution, all these things, we did everything in two platforms, email and chat rooms.
Like IRC or something?
IRC. It's all, and now we use Slack, right?
Let's not explain to the young people what that is.
Yeah,
you missed it.
Yeah, it was like SMS. It was like group chat, and so it was a support network of people in IRC on different channels of.
Got it.
And a lot of those people have gone on to do interesting things. So it's been a support network really for many, many years.
Do you think of yourself as like a natural networker? Do you do that naturally? Or did you learn
that
skill? Or
no,
do you just feel like IRC made it feel like you weren't doing it actively, but it just happened?
The thing about IRC that I think is different than a hallway conversation at a conference is anybody can participate.
And leveling.
Yes. There's no, you know, when I used to go to conferences and I was a nobody and you see a figure like Dennis Ritchie was there, right?
Sure.
I was like, how do I approach him? Do I fanboy him? Do I say, you're amazing? Mm-hmm. And then what is he going to say? Oh, okay,
yes,
thank you.
yeah.
Or you say something controversial. It's like, no. And the thing about IRC is that there's a discussion going on and you can join a discussion. You can maybe have a, you know, interject something. They'll teach you something. They'll correct you. There's kind of a, it's a more egalitarian thing.
Sure.
I don't think that there's as much rank when it comes to IRC conversations. So I think that the support network of IRCs, sadly, it's gone, right? People are now kind of these silos with Slack.
Sort of like private Slacks. And
yes,
whatnot.
And I don't like private Slacks. It's very siloed. Very siloed. I wish there was something open, as good as IRC was back in the day. But there's a sense of community.
Got it. So is that actually like where did you figure out that was you were gonna have to put this network together? Did you get advice there or no?
No, it was just it's a bunch of us kids, right? We're a bunch of kids talking on IRC, having bold ideas. I mean, the reason
the bold ideas thing seems important to me, right? Like in some ways, like at the beginning of your story, right?
Yeah.
There's this manifesto you read.
Yes.
And in some ways, you're kind of inspired. You combine that with the other thing, which is this like, then you read this book and it's like, you can do big creative things, not small little niggling around the edges kind of things. And in some ways, it kind of gave you permission to shoot a little higher?
Yeah, so the book came in 2000 and I had already done GNOME and Linux at that point. But I think it was just a lot of people that were very enthusiastic and they were willing, everybody was willing to pitch in their area of expertise.
Got it.
And people were fairly open to contribute and build something together. So I really think that this is the internet at its best, right? When we talked about what is the great thing about the internet in the early days, people say, well, I can talk to my dog, right? But to me it was the fact that we could distill, right? People that were passionate about a particular thing, but they happened to be in the middle of God knows where.
Got it.
And they were able to contribute. I'll give you an example. My spreadsheet, Gnomeric, we implemented a lot of the functions, but there was one guy in the middle of God knows where. I'm going to have to go and look up the name now, but he contributed the statistical functions to Gnomeric and said, listen, I'm going to give you this. This is what I do. He's a mathematician, and I hate the statistical behavior in Excel because it's unstable.
Got it.
So I'm going to give you the proper implementation of these statistical things, right?
And
what are the odds?
Right.
What are the odds of finding this professor that did that, right, to do this? There was another case, somebody that had spent his years studying calendars and calendaring systems. And that person came to Mon and said, you need a calendar. I can build it for you. And that was his passion. He knew calendars left and right.
Had this way of kind of finding these people in the universe so that you could kind of get
the goals. They heard about it, they read about the project somewhere, they joined the effort, and they live in the middle of God knows where, they have other jobs.
They had a contribution to make, and you kind of created an environment where they could come make.
Yes. So that is the internet at its best. That is the, not the internet at its worst that we're witnessing now, right? This is the internet when you can harness the good and you can harness people's desire to build something together.
Okay, I got to get you on a plane, so we got to get
two
more questions real quick. First of all, any really bad career advice that you wish you had, that you followed on accident and wish had never crossed your path?
Well, I really wish the Novell lawyers hadn't told me that's a conflict of interest. You shouldn't invest in Unity. Worst business advice ever. all right, there you have it.
Okay.
Worst business advice.
All right, last topic.
Yes.
Productivity hacks. What do you? You are relatively prolific, sir. You get a bunch done. Do you have any particular tips and tricks that you rely on to get that going, or?
Well, in
Latin, or is it just the Norton Commander thing?
No. I like to set time aside to actually to focus. Either I want to read, like for example, right now my current schedule is on Fridays.
Yeah.
I don't code and do anything at night. I go home and I read my books. Right. So I try to keep Fridays reserved for that. I did stop using Facebook about a year and a half ago.
Okay.
So once the kids go to sleep, I used to go to Facebook and check out them friends.
Got it.
And this just became a thing. Like you check out them people. Yeah. And I realized this is just burning all my time. So I cut that off. And now after the kids go to sleep, I still enjoy programming.
Yeah.
It's nothing really useful. It doesn't really go into the product, but I like learning. I like using my product. I like experimenting and,
So every night, you just create that space in your...
Yeah, so every night I give 1 hour, 2 hours of coding. So I still enjoy that. I enjoy that. I don't know. I think I have 4 users for my open source. maybe 5 after this talk. But I do enjoy doing that. And, on the other hand, the thing where I think that you and I are collaborating, and our teams are collaborating, I think that what we have is 2 teams that are really firing and all... on all cylinders, right? We have people that know the product very well. We know where the gaps are. We've gone to a place where we have an excellent product and now people are using it. And we're getting a lot of feedback about what things people need and what are the gaps. So I think that we're in a very interesting place where your engineers and my engineers are coming with fantastic solutions. I mean, there's a fantastic discussion on strings right now. On GitHub, and I'm gonna go on and troll that in a second. I have strong opinions on this, but
watch out, everybody.
No, it's good. I think we should unify. String should do multiple encodings. Jan Cortes is not gonna like this. I think that right now we have 2 teams, right? My mobile team and your .NET team that know exactly what needs to be done, and we're just trying right now. We're at a point where we're prioritizing the work, but we know that there's customers that need it, that there's solutions to be delivered, that that we're making people happy, that we're lowering their electricity bill, right? and we're making good tools. We're making happy developers.
That's our next contribution, right? In the long chain there. All right, Miguel.
Thank you so much.
Enjoy.
Thank you very much.
Okay.